hung all around us. The bridge was the only way across that I could see. "Still disappointed?" I asked Emma.
"Downright insulted," she replied. "It's like they're not even trying to keep us out."
"Yeah, that's what worries me." Addison gasped and his eyes sprang open. They shone electric.
"What is it?" Emma said, breathless.
"It's only the faintest of traces, but I'd know Balenciaga Wren's scent anywhere."
"And the others?"
Addison sniffed again.
"There were more of our kind with her. I can't say who, precisely, or how many. The trail goes quite muddy. Many peculiars have come this way recently, and I don't mean them," he said, looking banefully at the squatters behind us. "Their peculiar essence is weak, almost non-existent."
"Then that woman we interrogated was telling the truth," I said. "This is where the whites bring their captives. Our friends were here." Ever since they'd been taken, an awful, suffocating hopelessness had been tightening around my heart, but its grip loosened now, slightly. For the first time in hours, we were running on more than just hope and guesswork. We had tracked our friends across hostile territory all the way to the whites' doorstep. That in itself was a small victory, and it made me feel, if only for a moment, like anything was possible.
"Then it's even stranger that no one's guarding this place," Emma said darkly. "I don't like this at all."
"I don't either," I said. "But I don't see any other way across."
"I might as well get it over with," said Addison.
"We'll come with you as far as we can," said Emma.
"I appreciate that," Addison replied, sounding somewhat less than extremely intrepid.
The bridge could be sprinted across in under a minute, I guessed. But why run? Because, I thought, a line from Tolkien materializing in my head, one does not simply walk into Mordor. We started across at a brisk pace, murmurs and muted laughs following us. I glanced back at the squatters. Certain we were about to meet some grisly end, they were shifting around, angling for good views. All they needed was popcorn. I wanted to go back and pitch every last one into the boiling river.
"In a few days we'll have their drippings."
I didn't know what that meant, and hoped I never would. The bridge steepened. An encroaching paranoia was making my heart beat double time. I felt sure something was about to swoop down and we'd have nowhere to run. I felt like a mouse scurrying toward a trap. In whispers, we reviewed our plan. Get Addison through the gate, then fall back to the shanty town and find somewhere unobtrusive to wait. If he hadn't returned within 3 hours, Emma and I would find a way in. We were coming to the crest of the bridge, beyond which I'd be able to see a small section of the downslope that till now had been hidden. And then the lamp posts shouted,
"Stop! Who goes there? None shall pass!"
We stopped and gaped at them, stunned to realize they weren't lamp posts at all, but desiccated heads impaled on long pikes. They were horrible. Skin drawn and gray, tongues lolling, and yet, despite not being attached to throats, 3 of the heads had spoken to us. There were 8 altogether, mounted in pairs on either side of the bridge. Only Addison seemed unsurprised.
"Don't tell me you've never seen a bridge head," he said.
"Go no further,"
said the head on our left.
Almost certain death awaits those who cross without permission. Perhaps you should say certain death, said the head on our right. Almost sounds wishy-washy.
We have permission, I said, improvising a lie. I'm a white, and I'm delivering these two captured peculiars to call.
No one told us, the head on the left said irritably. Do they look captured to you, Richard? Said the one on the right. I couldn't tell you, said the left. Ravens pecked out my eyes weeks ago. Yours too, said the right. Pity. He don't sound like any white I know, said the left. What's your name, sirrah?
Smith, I said.
Ah, we don't have a Smith, said the right.
I just joined up.
Nice try. No, I don't think we'll let you through.
And who's going to stop us? I said.
Obviously not us, said the left. We're just here to forebode.
And to inform, said the right. Did you know I took a degree in museum studies? I never wanted to be a bridgehead.
No one wants to be a bridgehead, snapped the left. No child grows up dreaming of becoming a bloody bridgehead, foreboding at people all day and having your eyes pecked out by ravens. But life doesn't always scatter roses at your feet, does it?
Let's go, muttered Emma. All they can do is natter at us. We ignored them and continued up the bridge, each head warning us in turn as we passed.
Step no further, shouted the fourth.
Continue at your peril,
wailed the fifth.
I don't think they're listening, said the sixth.
Oh, well, said the seventh airily. Don't say we didn't warn you.
The eighth only stuck out his fat green tongue at us. Then we were beyond them and cresting the bridge, and there it came to a sudden end, a yawning 20-foot gap in the place where stone should have been, and I nearly stepped into it. Emma caught me as I reeled backward, arms pinwheeling. They didn't finish the damned bridge, I said, my cheeks flushing with adrenaline and embarrassment. I could hear the heads laughing at me, and behind them, the road squatters. If we'd been going at a run, we wouldn't have stopped in time and would have pitched right over the edge.
Are you all right? Emma asked me.
I'm fine, I said. But we're not. How are we supposed to get Addison across now?
This is vexing, said Addison, pacing along the edge. I don't suppose we could jump.
No chance, I said. It'd be way too far, even at a full run, even with a pole vault.
Huh,
said Emma. She looked behind us. You just gave me an idea. I'll be right back. Addison and I watched as she marched down the bridge. At the first head she came to, she stopped, wrapped her hands around the pike it was impaled on, and pulled. The pike came out with ease. As the head protested loudly, she laid it on the ground, planted her foot on its face, and gave a mighty yank. The pike slid free of the head, which went rolling off down the bridge, howling with rage. Emma returned triumphant, stood the pike at the edge of the gap, and let it fall across with a loud metallic clang. Emma looked at it and frowned.
Well, it isn't London Bridge.
20 feet long by 1 inch wide and slightly bowed in the middle, it looked like something a circus acrobat might balance on.
Let's get a few more, I suggested.
We ran back and forth, prying up pikes and laying them across the gap. The heads spat and swore and issued empty threats. When the last of them had been pried off and rolled away, we'd made a small metal bridge, roughly a foot wide, slippery with head goo and rattling in the ashy breeze.
"For England!"
Addison said, and he shimmied haltingly onto the pikes.
"For Miss Peregrine," I said, following him.
"For the love of birds, just go," said Emma, and she stepped on behind me. Addison slowed us down badly. His little legs kept slipping between the pikes, which made the pikes roll like axles and gave me awful stomach flutters. I tried focusing on where to place my feet without seeing past them into the chasm, but it was impossible. The boiling river attracted my eyes like a magnet, and I found myself wondering whether we were high enough for the fall alone to kill me, or whether I'd survive long enough to feel myself cooking to death. Addison, meanwhile, had given up trying to walk altogether, and instead laid down, whereupon he began to push himself along the pikes like a slug. In this way we proceeded, inch by undignified inch, to just beyond the halfway point, and then my flutters sharpened and gave way to something else, a knot in my stomach that I'd come to know all too well. Hollow. I tried to say it aloud, but my mouth had gone dry. By the time I'd swallowed and got the word out, the feeling had multiplied tenfold.
"What dreadful luck," Addison said. "Is it ahead of us or behind?"
I couldn't tell right away and had to poke around the feeling for a moment before I could pin it down.
"Jacob! Ahead or behind?" Emma shouted in my ear.
"Ahead." My gut compass was certain, but it made no sense. The downward slope of the bridge was now visible all the way to the gate, and the whole length was deserted. There was nothing there.
"I don't know," I said. "Then keep going," Emma replied.
We were closer to the far side of the gap than the near. We'd be off the pikes faster if we continued forward. I shoved down my fear, bent and scooped up Addison, and started to run, slipping and wobbling on the unsteady pikes. The hollow felt close enough to touch, and I could hear it now, grunting toward us from some unseen place ahead. My eyes followed the sound to a spot in front of us, but below our feet, on the cutaway face of the bridge, where several tall, narrow apertures had been carved into the stone.
There.
The bridge was hollow, and a hollow was inside the bridge. Though its body would never fit through the openings in the stone, its tongues easily could. I'd made it across the pikes and onto solid bridge when I heard Emma cry out. I dropped Addison and spun to see her behind me, one of the hollow's tongues wrapped around her waist and whisking her into the air. She screamed my name and I screamed hers. The tongue flipped her upside down and shook her. She screamed again. There was no worse sound. Another of its tongues slapped the underside of the pikes, and our makeshift bridge went flying, clattering apart and plunging like matchsticks into the chasm below. Then the second tongue went for Addison, and the third punched me in the chest. I fell to the ground, the wind knocked out of me. While I struggled for a breath, the tongue slithered around my waist and scooped me into the air. The other had Addison by his hind legs. In a moment, all three of us were dangling upside down. Blood rushed to my head, darkening my vision. I could hear Addison barking and nipping at the tongue.
"Don't! It'll drop you!"
I shouted, but he kept on. Emma was helpless too. If she burned the tongue around her waist, the hollow would drop her.
"Talk to it, Jacob!" she shouted. "Make it stop!"
I twisted to see the narrow openings through which its tongues had squeezed. Its teeth gnawed at the stone slats. Its black eyes bulged hungrily. We hung like fruit on thick black vines, the chasm yawning below. I tried to speak its language.
"Set us down!"
I shouted, but what came out was English.
"Again!"
Addison said. I shut my eyes and imagined the hollow doing as I asked, then tried again.
"Put us down on the bridge!"
More English. This wasn't the hollow I'd come to know, the one I'd communed with for hours while it was frozen in ice. This was a new one, a stranger, and my connection with it was thin and weak. It seemed to sense that I was fumbling for a key to its brain, and it hauled us suddenly upward, as if winding up to fling us into the chasm. I had to connect, somehow, now.
"Stop!"
I screamed, my throat raw, and this time out came the guttural scratch of hollow speak. We jolted to a stop in midair. For a moment, we just hung there, swinging like laundry in a breeze. My words had done something, but not enough. I'd merely confused it.
"Can't breathe,"
Emma croaked. The tongue around her was squeezing too hard, and her face was turning purple.
"Put us down on the bridge,"
I said, in hollow again, the words clawing at my throat as they came. Every burst of hollow speak felt like I was coughing up staples. The hollow made an uncertain rattle. For an optimistic moment, I thought it might actually do as I'd asked. Then it snapped me up and down as fast and hard as you'd shake out a towel. Everything blurred and briefly went black. When I came to, my tongue was numb and I tasted blood.
"Tell it to put us down!"
Addison was shouting, but now I could hardly speak at all.
"I'm crying,"
I mumbled. I coughed, spitting out a mouthful of blood.
"Put us down,"
I said in broken-tongued English.
"Put us..."
I stopped, reoriented my brain, took a deep breath.
"Put us down on the bridge,"
I said in crisp, hollow speak. I repeated it three more times, hoping it might slip into some furrow of the hollow's reptilian brain.
"Put us down on the bridge. Put us down on the bridge. Put us down on the..."
It gave a sudden, bone-rattling roar of frustration, pulled me to the openings in the bridge where it was imprisoned, and roared again, flecks of black spittle spraying my face. Then it hauled all three of us up and hurled us back the way we'd come. We tumbled through the air for what felt like too long. We were falling now, I was sure of it, arcing downward to our doom, and then my shoulder connected with the hard stone of the bridge, and we slid and skidded all the way down its slope to the bottom. We were, miraculously, alive, banged up but conscious, our limbs still connected to our bodies. We'd tumbled down the smooth marble bridge, scattering the pile of heads at the bottom as we rolled to a stop. They were all around now, taunting us as we collected ourselves.
"Welcome back," said the one nearest me. "We quite enjoyed your screams of terror. What powerful lungs you have."
"Why didn't you tell us a hollow was hiding in the damned bridge?"
I said, rocking myself up to a sitting position. Pains flared all over my body, from scraped hands, scuffed knees, and a throbbing shoulder that was likely dislocated.
"Where's the fun in that? Surprises are much better.
Tickles must have taken a fancy to you, said another. He chewed the legs off his last visitor.
That's nothing, said a head with a shiny hoop earring like a pirate. Once I saw him tie a rope around a peculiar, lower him into the river for 5 minutes, then reel him up and eat him.
Peculiar al dente, the third said, impressed.
Our Tickles is a gourmand.
Not quite ready to stand, I scooted over a few feet to Emma and Addison. While she sat rubbing her head, he tested his weight on an injured paw.
You okay?
I asked.
I knocked my head pretty good,
Emma replied, wincing as I parted her hair to examine a trickle of blood. Addison held up a limp paw.
I fear it's broken. I don't suppose you could have asked the beast to set us down gently.
Very funny, I said. Come to think of it, why didn't I just tell it to kill all the whites and rescue our friends, too?
Actually, I was wondering the same thing, said Emma.
I'm joking.
Well, I'm not, she said.
I dabbed at her wound with my shirt cuff. She drew a sharp breath and pushed my hand away.
What happened back there?
I think the hollow understood me, but I couldn't make it obey. I don't have a connection with that hollow like I did with the other one. That beast was dead, crushed under a bridge and probably drowned, and now I was a little sorry about it.
How did you connect with the first one? Asked Addison.
I quickly recounted how I had found it frozen in ice up to its eyeballs, and after a night spent in strangely intimate hand-atop-head communion, I had, apparently, managed to safe-crack some vital part of its neurology.
If you had no connection with the bridge hollow, said Addison, why did it spare our lives?
Maybe I confused it? You need to get better at this, Emma said bluntly. We have to get Addison across. Better? What am I supposed to do, take lessons? That thing will kill us the next time we get near it. We'll have to find another way across.
Jacob, there is no other way.
Emma raked a veil of mussed hair away from her face and held me with her eyes.
You're the way.
I was launching into a creaky rebuttal when I felt a sharp pain in my backside and leapt, yelping, to my feet. One of the heads had bitten me on the ass.
Hey!
I shouted, rubbing the spot.
Stick us back on our pikes like you found us, vandal,
it said. I punted it as hard as I could, and it tumbled away into the crowd of squatters. All the heads began to shout and curse us, rolling about grotesquely with the action of their jaws. I cursed back and kicked ash in their horrible leathery faces until they were all spitting and choking. And then something small and round came sailing through the air and hit me wetly in the back. A rotten apple. I spun to face the squatters.
Who threw that?
They laughed like stoners, low and snickering.
Go back where you came from,
one of them yelled. I was starting to think that wasn't a bad idea.
How dare they?
Addison snarled. Forget it, I said to him, my anger already fading. Let's just...
How dare you?
Addison shouted, livid, rising up to address them on hind legs.
Are you not peculiar? Have you no shame? We're trying to help you.
Give us a vial or get stuffed,
said a ragged woman. Addison trembled with outrage.
We're trying to help you, he said again.
And here you are! Here you are! While our people are being murdered, our loops torn out root and branch, sleeping before the enemy's gate! You should be flinging yourselves at it!
He pointed his wounded paw at them.
You are all traitors, and I swear one day I shall see you dragged before the Council of Imbrans and punished!
Okay, okay, don't waste all your energy on them, Emma said, wobbling to her feet. Then a rotten head of cabbage bounced off her shoulder and fell splat to the ground. She lost it.
All right, someone's gonna get their face melted, she yelled, waving a flaming hand at the squatters.
During Addison's speech, a group had been muttering in a conspiratorial huddle, and now they came forward holding blunt weapons, a sawed branch, a length of pipe. The scene was turning ugly, fast.
We're tired of you,
a bruised man said in a lazy drawl.
We're putting you in the river.
I'd like to see that, Emma said.
I wouldn't, I said. I think we should go. There were six of them, three of us, and we were in rough shape. Addison was limping, Emma had blood running down her face, and thanks to my injured shoulder, I could hardly lift my right arm. Meanwhile, the men were spreading apart and closing in. They meant to drive us into the chasm. Emma looked back at the bridge and then at me.
Come on. I know you can get us across. One more try.
I can't, Em. I can't. I'm not messing around. And I wasn't. I didn't have it in me to control that hollow, not yet, at least, and I knew it.
If the boy says he can't do it, I'm not inclined to disbelieve him, Addison said. We must find another way out of this.
Emma huffed.
Like what?
She looked at Addison.
Can you run?
She looked at me.
Can you fight?
The answer to both was no. I took her point. Our options were winnowing fast.
At times like this, Addison said imperiously, my kind don't fight. We orate.
Facing the men, he called out in a booming voice,
Fellow peculiars, be reasonable. Allow me a few words.
They paid him no attention. As they continued closing off our escape routes, we backed toward the bridge, Emma crafting the largest fireball she could muster, while Addison yammered about how the animals of the forest live in harmony, so why can't we?
Consider the simple hedgehog and his neighbor, the opossum. Do they waste their energy trying to throw one another into chasms when they face a common enemy, the winter? No!
He's gone completely crackers, Emma said. Shut your gob and bite one of them!
I looked around for something to fight with. The only hard objects within reach were the heads. I picked up one by the last wisps of its hair.
Is there another way across?
I shouted into its face.
Quick, or I'm throwing you into the river!
Go to hell!
It spat, then snapped at me with its teeth. I flung it at the men, awkwardly, with my left arm. It fell short. I rooted around for another head, picked it up, and repeated my question.
Sure there is, the head sneered. In the back of a prizo van. Though if I were you, I'd take my chances with the bridge hollow.
What's a prizo van? Tell me or I'll fling you too.
You're about to get hit by one,
it replied. And then three gunshots rang out in the distance.
Bam! Bam! Bam!
Slow and measured, like a warning. Immediately, the men who'd been coming at us stopped, and everyone turned to look down the road. Half-drawn through a cloud of swirling ash, something large and boxy was rumbling toward us. Then came the growl of a big engine downshifting, and out of the black appeared a truck. It was a modern machine of military issue, all rivets and reinforcements and tires half a man high. The back was a windowless cube, and two flak-jacketed machine-gun-armed whites stood guard along its running boards. The moment it appeared, the squatters went into a kind of frenzy, laughing and gasping for joy, waving their arms and clasping their hands like marooned shipwreck survivors flagging down a passing plane. And just like that, we were forgotten. A golden opportunity had smacked into us, and we weren't about to waste it. I tossed aside the head, scooped Addison into the crook of my left arm, and scrambled out of the road after Emma. We could have kept going, cut away from Smoking Street, and retreated to some safer quarter of Devil's Acre. But here, finally, was our enemy in the flesh, and whatever was happening or about to happen was clearly of importance. We stopped not far off the roadside, barely hidden behind a knot of charred trees, and watched. The truck slowed, and the crowd swarmed it, groveling and begging for vials, for Suli and Ambro, and just a taste, just a little, please, sir. Disgusting in their worship of these butchers, pawing at the soldiers' clothes and shoes and getting steel-toed kicks in return. I thought surely the whites would start shooting or gun the engine and crush those foolish enough to stand between them and the bridge. Instead, the truck stopped, and the whites began to shout instructions.
"Form a line right over here! Keep orderly, or you'll get nothing!"
The crowd fell into formation like destitutes in a bread line, cowed and fidgeting in anticipation of what they were about to receive. Without warning, Addison began to struggle to be set down. I asked him what was the matter, but he only whimpered and struggled harder, a desperate look on his face like he'd just caught a major scent trail. Emma pinched him, and he snapped out of it long enough to say,
"It's her! It's her! It's Miss Wren!"
And I realized that Prizo Van was short for Prison Van, and that the cargo in the back of the white's enormous vehicle was almost certainly human. Then Addison bit me. I yelped and let him go, and in an instant he was scrambling away. Emma swore, and I said, "Addison, don't!" But it was useless. He was operating on instinct, the irrepressible reflex of a loyal dog trying to protect his master. I dove for him and missed. He was surprisingly speedy for a creature with just 3 working legs. And then Emma hauled me up, and together we were after him, out of our hiding place and into the road. There was a moment, a fleeting instant, when I thought we could catch him, that the soldiers were too mobbed and the crowd too preoccupied to notice us. And it might have happened but for the shift that came over Emma halfway across the road, when she spied the doors at the back of the truck. Doors with locks that could be melted. Doors that could be flung open, she must have thought. I could read it in the hope dawning on her face. And she passed Addison without even reaching for him and clambered onto the truck's bumper. Shouts from the guards. I grabbed for Addison, but he slid away under the truck. Emma was starting to melt the handle of one door when the first guard swung his gun like a baseball bat. It hit her in the side, and she tumbled to the ground. I ran at the guard, ready to do to him whatever I could with my one good arm, but my legs were kicked out from under me, and I crashed down onto my hurt shoulder, a thunderbolt of pain surging through me. Hearing the guard scream, I looked up, saw him unarmed and waving an injured hand, and then he was tripping away into the mad swim of churning bodies. The squatters swarmed him, not just begging, but demanding, threatening, crazed. And now, somewhere, one of them had his weapon. Looking panicked, he waved to the other white with the two hands over the head, "Get me out of here!" I struggled to my feet and ran for Emma. The other guard dove into the crowd, firing into the air until he could pull out his comrade and get back to the truck. The moment their feet hit the running boards, they slapped the side of the truck, and the engine roared. I reached Emma just as it took off for the bridge, its monster tires spitting gravel and ash. I clasped her arm to reassure myself she was still whole. "You're bleeding," I said. "A lot," which was a clunky statement of fact, but also the best I could articulate how awful it felt to see her hurt, limping, a gash on her scalp leaking blood into her hair. "Where's Addison?" she said. But before "I don't know" had left my lips, she interrupted. "We've got to go after it. This may be our only chance." We looked up as the truck was reaching the bridge and saw the guard gun down two squatters chasing after it. As they fell writhing to the dirt, I knew she was wrong. There was no chasing down the truck, no getting across the bridge. It was hopeless, and now the squatters knew it. As their comrades fell, I could feel their desperation turn to rage, and in what seemed an instant, that rage turned on us. We tried to run, but found ourselves blocked on all sides. The mob was shouting that we'd ruined it, that they'd cut us off now, that we deserved to die. Blows started raining down on us, slaps, punches, hands tearing at our hair and clothes. I tried to protect Emma, but she ended up protecting me, for a few moments at least, swinging her hands around, burning whomever she could. Even her fire wasn't enough to get them away from us, and the hits kept coming until we were on our knees, then balled up on the ground, arms protecting our faces, pain coming from every direction. I was almost sure I was dying or dreaming, because I heard at that moment, singing, a loud, peppy chorus of, "Hark to the driving of hammers, hark to the driving of nails," but with each line came a smattering of fleshy thuds and corresponding yelps. "What smack to build a gallows, the thwack for all that ails!" After a few lines and a few thwacks, the blows stopped raining down and the mob backed away, wary and grumbling. I saw dimly, through a haze of blood and grit, five brawny gallows riggers, tool belts hung from their waists and hammers raised in their hands. They'd cut a wedge through the crowd, and now they circled us, looking down doubtfully as if we were some strange species of fish they hadn't been expecting to find in their nets.
"Is this them?" I heard one of them say. "They don't look so good, cousin."
"Of course it's them," said another, his voice like a foghorn, deep and familiar.
"It's Sharon!" Emma cried. I could move my hand just enough to wipe one eye clear of blood. There he stood, all seven black-cloaked feet of him. I felt myself laugh, or try to. I'd never been so glad to see someone so ugly. He was digging something out of his pocket, little glass vials, and raised them above his head, shouting,
"I've got what you want right here, you sick monkeys!
Go take them and leave these children be!
He turned and threw the vials down the road. The mob flooded after them, gasping and shouting, ready to tear one another apart to get them. And then it was just the riggers, slightly rumpled from the melee but unscathed, tucking their hammers back into their belts. Sharon, striding toward us with one snow-white hand outstretched, was saying,
"What were you thinking, wandering off like that? I was worried sick."
"It's true," said one of the riggers. "He was beside himself. Had us looking everywhere for you."
I tried sitting up, but couldn't. Sharon was right over top of us, peering down like he was examining roadkill.
"Are you whole? Can you walk? What in the devil's name have these reprobates done to you?"
His tone was somewhere between angry drill sergeant and concerned father.
"Jacob's hurt," I heard Emma say, her voice cracking.
"So are you," I tried to say, but couldn't get my tongue straight. It seemed she was right. My head felt heavy as stone, and my vision was a failing satellite signal, good one moment, gone the next. I was being lifted, carried in Sharon's arms. He was much stronger than he looked, and I had a sudden flashing thought, which I tried to say aloud. "Where's Addison?" I was all mush-mouthed, but somehow he understood me, and turning my head toward the bridge, he said,
"There."
In the distance, the truck seemed to be floating in midair. Was my concussed brain playing tricks? No. I could see it now. The truck was being lifted across the gap by the hollow's tongues. But where's Addison?
"There," Sharon repeated. "Underneath."
Two hind legs and a small brown body dangled from the truck's underside. Addison had clamped onto some part of its undercarriage with his teeth and caught a ride, the clever devil. And as the tongues deposited the truck on the far side of the bridge, I thought, "Godspeed, intrepid little dog. You may be the best hope we've got." And then I was fading, fading, the world irising toward night.
Chapter 4. Turbulent dreams, dreams in strange languages, dreams of home, of death. Odd bits of nonsense that spooled out in flickers of consciousness, swimmy and unreliable, inventions of my concussed brain. A faceless woman blowing dust into my eyes. A sensation of being immersed in warm water. Emma's voice assuring me everything would be okay. They're friends. We're safe. Then deep and dreamless dark for unknown hours. The next time I woke, I wasn't dreaming, and I knew it. I was tucked into a bed in a small room. Weak light spilled from behind a drawn window shade. So, daytime. But what day? I was in a nightgown, not my old blood-stained clothes, and my eyes were clear of grit. Someone had been taking care of me. Also, though I was bone-tired, I felt little pain. My shoulder had stopped aching, and so had my head. I wasn't sure what that meant. I tried sitting up. I had to stop halfway and rest on my elbows. A glass pitcher of water stood on a night table by the bedside. In one corner of the room was a hulking wooden wardrobe. In the other, I blinked and rubbed my eyes, making sure, yes, there was a man sleeping in a chair. My mind was moving so sluggishly that I wasn't even startled. I merely thought, that's odd. And he was, so odd-looking, in fact, that I struggled briefly to understand what I was seeing. He seemed a man composed of halves. Half his hair was slicked down, while the other half was cowlicked all over the place. Half his face was scraggly beard, and the other half clean-shaven. Even his clothes, pants, rumpled sweater, ruffled Elizabethan collar, were half modern, half archaic. "Hello?" I said uncertainly. The man shouted, startling so badly that he fell out of his chair and landed on the floor in a clatter.
"Oh my! Oh goodness!"
He climbed back into the chair, eyes wide and hands aflutter.
"You're awake!"
"Sorry, I didn't mean to scare you."
"Ah, no, it was my fault entirely,"
he said, smoothing his clothes and straightening his ruffled collar.
"Please don't tell anyone I fell asleep watching you."
"Who are you?" I asked. "Where am I?" My mind was clearing fast, and as it did, it filled with questions. "And where's Emma?"
"Right, yes,"
the man said, looking flustered. "I might not be the best equipped member of the household to answer questions." He whispered the word, eyebrows raised, as if questions were forbidden.
"But,"
he pointed at me,
"you're Jacob."
He pointed at himself.
"I'm Nim."
He made a whirling motion with his hand.
"And this is Mr. Bentham's house. He's very eager to meet you. In fact, I'm to notify him as soon as you're awake."
I squirmed up from my elbows to sit fully upright, the effort of which nearly exhausted me.
"I don't care about any of that. I want to see Emma." "Of course, your friend."
He flapped his hands like little wings while his eyes darted from side to side, as if he might find Emma in a corner of the room.
"I want to see her. Now!" "My name's Nim,"
he squeaked.
"And I'm to notify, yes, under strict instructions."
A panicky thought flew into my head, that Sharon, mercenary that he was, had rescued us from the mob, only to sell us for spare parts.
"Emma!"
I managed to shout.
"Where are you?"
Nim went blank and plopped into the chair. I'd scared him silly, I think. A moment later, feet came pounding down the hall. A man in a white coat burst into the room.
"You're awake!"
he exclaimed. I could only assume he was a doctor.
"I want to see Emma!"
I said. I tried to swing my legs out of the bed, but they felt heavy as logs. The doctor rushed to my side and pushed me back toward the sheets.
"Don't exert yourself. You're still recovering."
The doctor ordered Nim to go find Mr. Bentham. Nim ran out, bouncing off the door jamb and flopping into the hall. And then Emma was at the door, out of breath and beaming, her hair spilling down a clean white dress.
"Jacob?"
At the sight of her, a burst of strength coursed through me, and I sat up, pushing the doctor aside.
"Emma!
You're awake,"
she said, running to me.
"Careful with him, he's delicate,"
the doctor warned. Checking herself, Emma gave me the gentlest of hugs, then sat on the edge of the bed next to me.
"I'm sorry I wasn't here when you woke up. They said you'd be out for hours more."
"It's okay," I said. "But where are we? How long have we been here?" Emma glanced at the doctor. He was writing in a small notebook, but obviously listening. Emma turned her back to him and lowered her voice.
We're at a rich man's house in Devil's Acre, some place hidden. Sharon brought us here a day and a half ago.
Is that all? I said, studying Emma's face. Her skin was perfectly smooth, her cuts faded to thin white lines.
You look almost healed. I only had a few nicks and bumps.
No way, I said. I remember what happened out there.
You had a broken rib and a torn shoulder, the doctor interjected.
They have a woman here, Emma said. A healer. Her body produces a powerful dust.
And a double concussion, said the doctor. Nothing we couldn't handle in the end. But you, boy, you were nearly dead when you arrived.
I patted my chest, my stomach, all the places I'd been pummeled. No pain. I lifted my right arm and rotated the shoulder. No problem.
It feels like I've got a new arm, I said, marveling.
You're lucky you didn't need a new head, came another voice.
Sharon, ducking to fit his full height through the doorway.
In fact, it's a shame they didn't give you one, because apparently the one you've got now is full of sawdust. Disappearing like that, running off without a clue where you were going, and after all my warnings about the acre. What were you thinking?
He towered over Emma and me, wagging his long white finger. I grinned at him. Hello, Sharon. Nice to see you again.
Yes, ha-ha, it's all smiles now that everything's rosy. But you nearly got yourselves killed out there.
We were lucky, Emma said.
Yes, lucky I was there. Lucky my gallows rigging cousins were available that evening, and I was able to catch them before they'd had too much ditch lager at the Cradle and Coffin. They don't work for free, by the way. I'm adding their services to your tab, along with my damaged boat.
Fine, fine, I said. Settle down, okay?
What were you thinking?
He said again, his awful breath settling over us like a cloud. And then it came back to me, what I'd been thinking, and I kind of lost it.
That you were an untrustworthy lout, I fired back. That it's only about money with you, and you probably would have sold us into slavery the first chance you got.
Yeah, I said, we looked into it. We know all about the shady things you peculiars get up to around here, and if you think for a minute we believe that you, I pointed at Sharon, or any of you, I pointed at the doctor, are helping us purely out of kindness, you're nuts. So either tell us what you want with us or let us go, because we've got... A sudden crashing wave of exhaustion, my vision unfocused.
Got better things to...
I shook my head, tried standing up, but the room had begun to spin. Emma held my arms and the doctor pushed me back gently onto my pillow.
We're helping you because Mr. Bentham asked us to, he said tersely. What he wants with you, well, you'll have to ask him yourself.
Like I keep saying, Mr. Whoever can kiss my... Oof.
Emma clapped a hand over my mouth.
Jacob's not feeling himself at the moment, she said. I'm sure what he meant to say was, thanks for saving us. We're in your debt.
That too,
I mumbled through her fingers. I was angry and scared, but also genuinely happy to be alive and to see Emma whole and healed. When I thought about that, all the fight leaked out of me, and I was filled with simple gratitude. I closed my eyes to stop the room from spinning and listened to them whisper about me.
He's a problem,
said the doctor. He can't be allowed to meet Mr. Bentham like this.
His brain is addled, Sharon said. If the girl and I could just talk with him in private, I'm sure he could be brought around. Might we have the room to ourselves?
Reluctantly, the doctor left. When he was gone, I opened my eyes again and focused on Emma, looking down at me. "Where's Addison?" I asked.
"He got across," she said.
"Right," I said, remembering. "Have you heard from him? Has he come back yet?"
"No," she said quietly. "Not yet."
I considered what that might mean, what might have happened to him, but I couldn't bear the thought. "We promise to go after him," I said. "If he can get across, so can we."
"That bridge hollow might not have cared about a dog getting across," Sharon butted in. "But you, he'd peel off and toss right into the boil."
"Go away," I said to him. "I want to talk to Emma in private."
"Why? So he can climb out the window and run away again?"
"We're not going anywhere," Emma said. "Jacob can't even get out of bed."
Sharon wasn't swayed.
"I'll go to the corner and mind my own business," he said. "That's my best offer."
He went and perched himself on Nim's one-armed chair and began to whistle and clean his fingernails. Emma helped me sit up, and we pressed our foreheads together and spoke in whispers. For a moment, I was so overwhelmed by her closeness that all the questions flooding my brain vanished, and there was only her hand touching my face, brushing my cheek, my jaw.
"You had me so frightened," Emma said. "I really thought I'd lost you."
"I'm fine," I said. I knew I hadn't been, but it embarrassed me to be worried over.
"You weren't, not at all. You should apologize to the doctor."
"I know. I was just freaked out. And I'm sorry if I scared you." She nodded and then looked away. Her eyes drifted briefly to the wall, and when they returned, a new hardness glittered in them.
"I like to think I'm strong," she said. "But the reason I'm free right now instead of Bronwyn or Millard or Enoch is that I'm strong enough to be depended upon. That's always been me, the one who could take anything. Like there's a pain sensor inside me that's not switched on. I can block out awful things and get on with it, do what needs doing."
Her hand found mine atop the sheets. Our fingers knotted together, automatic.
"But when I think about you, how you looked when they pulled you off the ground after those people."
She let out a shaky breath and shook her head as if chasing away the memory.
"I just break."
"Me too," I said, remembering the pain I felt whenever I saw Emma hurt, the terror that gripped me every time she was in danger.
"Me too."
I squeezed her hand and searched for something more to say, but she spoke first.
"I need you to promise me something."
"Anything," I said.
"I need you not to die."
I cracked a smile. Emma didn't.
"You can't," she said. "If I lose you, the rest isn't worth a damn."
I slid my arms around her, pulled her tight against me. "I'll do my best."
"That's not good enough," she whispered. "Promise me."
"Okay. I won't die."
"Say I promise." I promise. You say it too.
I promise, she said.
Ah, Sharon said airily from the corner. The sweet lies lovers tell.
We broke apart. You're not supposed to be listening, I said.
That was long enough, he said, dragging his chair loudly across the floor and planting it next to the bed. We have important things to discuss, namely the apology you owe me.
For what? I said, irritated.
Impugning my character and reputation.
Every word was true, I said. This loop is full of scumbags and creeps, and you are a money-driven lout.
With not an ounce of sympathy for the plight of his own people, Emma added. Though, again, thank you for saving us.
Around here you learn to look out for number one, Sharon said. Everyone's got a story, a plight. Everyone wants something from you, and they're almost always lying. So yes, I remain unapologetically self-directed and profit-motivated. But I deeply resent your suggestion that I would have dealings of any kind with someone who trades in peculiar flesh. Just because I'm a capitalist doesn't mean I'm a black-hearted bastard.
And how could we have known that? I said. We had to beg and bribe you not to abandon us at the dock, remember?
He shrugged.
That was before I realized who you are.
I glanced at Emma, then pointed to my chest. Who I am?
You, my boy. Mr. Bentham's been waiting a long time to speak to you. Since the day I first hung my shingle as a boatman, 40-odd years ago. Bentham ensured me safe passage in and out of the acre if I promised to keep an eye out for you while I did it. I was to bring you to see him. And now, finally, I've kept my end of the bargain.
You must have me confused with someone else, I said. I'm nobody.
He said you'd be able to speak to Hologast. How many peculiars do you know who can do that?
But he's only 16, Emma said. Really 16. So how can...
That's why it took me a while to put it all together, said Sharon. I had to go see Mr. Bentham about it personally, which is where I was when you two ran away. You don't fit the description, see? All these years I've been keeping watch for an old man.
An old man, I said.
Right.
Who can talk to hollows.
As I said.
Emma tightened her grip on my hand, and we exchanged a look. No, it couldn't be. And then I swung my legs out of bed, charged with new energy. I want to talk to this Bentham guy. Right now.
He'll see you when he's ready, Sharon said.
No, I said. Now. As it happened, at that very moment there was a knock at the door. Sharon opened it to find Nim.
Mr. Bentham will meet our guests for tea in 1 hour, he said. In the library.
We can't wait an hour, I said. We've wasted too much time here already. At this, Nim went a bit red and puffed out his cheeks.
Wasted? What Jacob meant, Emma said, is that we have another pressing engagement elsewhere in the acre that we're already late for.
Mr. Bentham insists upon meeting you properly, Nim said. As he always says, the day there's no time for manners, the world's lost to us anyway. Speaking of which, I'm to make sure you're dressed appropriately.
He went to the wardrobe and swung open its heavy doors. Inside were several racks of clothes.
You may choose what you like.
Emma pulled out a frilly dress and curled her lip.
This feels so wrong. Playing dress-up and having tea while our friends and Imbrins are forced to endure bird knows what.
We're doing it for them, I said. We only have to play along till Bentham tells us what he knows. It could be important.
Or he could just be a lonely old man.
Don't talk about Mr. Bentham that way, Nim said,
his face puckering.
Mr. Bentham is a saint, a giant among men.
Oh, calm down, Sharon said.
He went to the window and pulled open the blinds, allowing a weak pea soup daylight to dribble into the room.
Up and at 'em, he said to us. You two have a date.
I threw back my covers, and Emma helped me out of bed. To my surprise, my legs took my weight. I glanced out the window at an empty street enveloped in yellow murk, and then, with Emma holding my arm, went to the wardrobe to pick out a change of clothes. I found an outfit on a hanger tagged with my name.
Can we have some privacy to change, please? I said.
Sharon looked at Nim and shrugged. Nim's hands flapped.
It wouldn't be proper!
Ah, they're fine, Sharon said, waving his hand. No monkey business, all right?
Emma turned beet red.
I wouldn't have any idea what you mean.
Sure you wouldn't.
He shooed Nim out of the room, then paused at the doorway.
I can trust you not to run away again.
Why would we? I said. We want to meet Mr. Bentham.
We're not going anywhere, Emma said. But why are you still here?
Mr. Bentham asked me to keep an eye on you.
I wondered if that meant Sharon would stop us if we tried to leave.
Must be a pretty big favor you owed him, I said.
Massive,
he replied.
I owe the man my life.
And bending himself nearly in half, he squeezed out into the hallway.
You change clothes in there, Emma said, nodding toward a small connecting bathroom. I'll change in here, and no peeking until I knock.
Okay,
I said, exaggerating my disappointment in order to hide it. While seeing Emma in her underwear was an undeniably appealing prospect, all the life-threatening peril we'd endured lately had put that part of my teenage brain into a kind of deep freeze. A few more serious kisses, though, and my baser instincts might start to reassert themselves. But anyway, I shut myself in the bathroom, all gleaming white tile and heavy iron fixtures, and leaned over the sink to examine myself in a silvered mirror. I was a mess. My face was puffy and cross-hatched with angry pink lines, which were healing quickly but still there, reminders of every blow I'd suffered. My torso was a geography of bruises, painless but ugly. Blood was caked into the hard-to-clean folds of my ears. The sight of it made me dizzy, and I had to grip the sink to stay upright. I had a sudden nasty flashback, fists and feet thrashing at me, the ground rushing up. No one had ever tried to kill me with bare hands before. That was something new, much different than being hunted by hollows, which ran on instinct. Different, too, than being shot at. Bullets were a quick, impersonal way to kill. Using your hands, though, that took work. It required hate. It was a strange and sour thing to know that such hatred had been directed at me. That peculiars who didn't even know my name had, in a moment of collective madness, hated me enough to try to beat out my life with their fists. I felt shamed by it,
dehumanized somehow, though I couldn't exactly understand why. It was something I'd have to reckon with, if one day I ever had the luxury of time to reckon with such things. I turned on the tap to wash my face. The pipes shuddered and groaned, but after a big orchestral flourish, they produced only a hiccup of brown water. This Bentham fellow might have been rich, but no amount of luxury could cocoon him from the reality of the hellish place where he lived. How had he ended up here? More intriguing still, how did the man know, or know about, my grandfather? Surely that's who Sharon had been referring to when he said Bentham was looking for an old man who could speak to hollows. Perhaps my grandfather had met Bentham during his war years, after he'd left Miss Peregrine's house, but before he'd come to America. It was a defining period of his life which he'd spoken about only rarely and never in detail. Despite all I'd learned about my grandfather in the past few months, in many respects, he remained a mystery to me. Now that he was gone, I thought sadly, perhaps it would always be so. I put on the clothes Bentham had given me, a preppy-looking blue shirt and gray wool sweater combo with simple black pants. It all fit perfectly, as if they'd known I was coming. As I was slipping into a pair of brown leather Oxford shoes, Emma knocked on the door.
"How are you faring in there?"
I opened the door to a blast of yellow. Emma looked miserable in an enormous canary-colored dress with poofy sleeves and a hem that swam around her feet. She sighed.
"It was the lesser of many sartorial evils, I assure you."
"You look like Big Bird," I said, following her out of the bathroom, "and I look like Mr. Rogers. This Bentham is a cruel man." Both references were lost on her. Ignoring me, she crossed to the window and looked out.
"Yes, good."
"What's good?" I said.
"This ledge. It's the size of Cornwall, and there are handholds everywhere. Safer than a jungle gym."
"And why would we care about the safety of the ledge?" I asked, joining her at the window.
"Because Sharon's watching the hole, so obviously we can't go out that way."
Sometimes it seemed like Emma had whole conversations with me inside her head, ones I wasn't privy to, and then she'd get frustrated that I was confused when she finally let me in on them. Her brain worked so quickly that once in a while it got ahead of itself.
"We can't go anywhere," I said. "We've got to meet Bentham." "And we will, but I'll be hanged if I'm spending the next hour twiddling my thumbs in this room. Saintly Mr. Bentham is an exile living in Devil's Acre, which means he's likely a dangerous lowlife with a sordid past. I want to have a look round his house and see what we can find out. We'll be back before anyone notices we're gone. Word of honour."
"Ah, good, a stealth operation. We're dressed perfectly, then."
"Very funny."
I was in hard-soled shoes that made every footstep sound like a hammer blow. She was in a dress yellower than a hazard sign, and I'd only recently found the energy to stand on my own 2 feet. And yet I agreed. She was often right about these things, and I had come to depend on her instincts.
"If someone spots us, so be it," she said. "The man's waited eons to meet you, apparently. He's not going to kick us out now for giving ourselves a little tour."
She opened the window and climbed onto the ledge. I stuck my head out cautiously. We were 2 stories above an empty street in the good section of Devil's Acre. I recognized a stack of firewood. It was where we'd been hiding when Sharon exited the abandoned-looking storefront.
Directly below us was the law office of Munday, Dyson, and Stripe. There was no such firm, of course. It was a front, a secret entrance to Bentham's house. Emma offered her hand to me.
I know you're not a great fan of heights, but I won't let you fall.
After being dangled above a boiling river by a hollow, this little drop didn't seem so frightening. And Emma was right. The ledge was wide, and decorative knobs and gargoyle faces protruded everywhere from the masonry, making natural handholds. I climbed out, grabbed on, and shimmied along after her. When the ledge turned a corner and we felt fairly certain that we were paralleling a hallway out of Sharon's view, we tried opening a window. It was locked. We shimmied on and tried the next one, but it, too, was locked, as were the third, fourth, and fifth windows.
"We're running out of building," I said. "What if none of them open?"
"This next one will," Emma said.
"How do you know?"
"I'm clairvoyant."
And with that, she kicked it, sending shattered glass into the room and tinkling down the front of the building. "No, you're a hoodlum," I said. Emma grinned at me and then knocked the last few shards from the frame with the flat of her hand. She stepped through the opening. I followed, somewhat reluctantly, into a dark and cavernous room. It took a moment for our eyes to adjust. The only light came from the window shade we'd just broken, its puny glow revealing the edge of a pack rat's paradise. Wooden crates and boxes climbed to the ceiling in teetering stacks, leaving only a small aisle between them.
"I get the feeling Bentham doesn't like to throw things away," Emma said.
In reply, I released a rapid-fire triple sneeze. The air was swimming with dust. Emma blessed me and lit a flame in her hand, which she held up to the nearest crate. It was labeled RM-AM-157.
"What do you think is in them?" I said.
"We'd need a crowbar to find out," said Emma. "These are sturdy."
"I thought you were clairvoyant." She made a face at me. Lacking a crowbar, we ventured farther into the room, Emma enlarging her flame as we left the petering window light behind. The narrow path between the boxes led through an arched door and into another room, which was equally dark and nearly as cluttered. Instead of crates, it was crammed with bulky objects hidden beneath white dust covers. Emma was about to pull one away, but before she could, I caught her arm.
"What's wrong?"
she said, annoyed.
"There might be something awful under there."
"Yes, exactly," she said,
and tore away the cover, which scared up a cyclone of dust. When the air cleared, we saw ourselves reflected dimly in a glass-topped case of the sort you find in museums, waist high and about 4 feet square. Inside, neatly arranged and labeled, were a carved coconut husk, a whale vertebra fashioned into a comb, a small stone axe, and a few other items, the usefulness of which wasn't immediately obvious. A placard on the glass read, "Housewares used by peculiars on the island of Espiritu Santo, New Hebrides, South Pacific region, circa 1750.
"Huh,"
Emma said.
"Weird,"
I replied. She replaced the dust cover, even though there was little use in covering our tracks. It wasn't as if we could unbreak the window, and we moved slowly through the room, uncovering other objects at random. All were museum displays of one type or another. The contents bore little relation to one another, save that they had once been owned or used by peculiars.
One contained a selection of brightly colored silks worn by peculiars in the Far East, circa 1800. Another displayed what appeared at first glance to be a wide cross-section of tree trunk, but upon closer inspection was in fact a door with iron hinges and a knob made from a tree knot. Its placard read, "Entrance to a peculiar home in the great Hibernian wilderness, circa 1530.
"Wow," Emma said, leaning in for a closer look. "I never knew there were so many of us in the world."
"Or used to be," I said. "I wonder if they're still out there." The last display we looked at was labeled "Weaponry of the Hittite Peculiars, Kaimakli Underground City, no date." Bafflingly, all we could see inside were dead beetles and butterflies. Emma swung her flame around to look at me.
"I think we've established that Bentham's a history buff. Ready to move on?"
We hurried through two more rooms filled with dust-covered display cases, then arrived at a utilitarian staircase, which we climbed to the next floor. The landing door opened onto a long and lushly carpeted hallway. It seemed to go on forever, its regularly spaced doors and repeating wallpaper creating a dizzying impression of endlessness. We walked along, peeking into rooms. They were furnished identically, laid out identically, wallpapered identically. Each had a bed, a night table, and a wardrobe, just like the room I'd recuperated in. A pattern of red poppy vines curled across the wallpaper and continued through the carpeting in hypnotic waves, making the whole place seem like it was being slowly reclaimed by nature. In fact, the rooms would have been entirely indistinguishable had it not been for the small brass plaques nailed to the doors, which gave each a unique name. All were exotic-sounding. The Alps Room, the Gobi Room, the Amazon Room. Perhaps 50 rooms lined the hallway, and we were halfway down its length, hurrying now, certain there was nothing of use to be discovered here, when a blast of air rolled over us that was so cold it prickled my skin.
"Woo!"
I said, hugging myself. "Where'd that come from?"
"Could be someone left a window open," Emma said.
"But it's not cold outside," I said, and she shrugged. We continued down the hall, the air chilling more the farther we went. Finally, we turned a corner and came to a section of hall where icicles had formed on the ceiling and frost glistened on the carpet. The cold seemed to be emanating from one room in particular, and we stood before it watching flakes of snow waft one by one from the crack beneath its door.
"That is very strange," I said, shivering. "Definitely unusual," Emma agreed. "Even by my standards."
I stepped forward, my feet crunching on the snowy carpet, to examine the plaque on the door. It read, "The Siberia Room." I looked at Emma. She looked at me.
"It's probably just a hyperactive air conditioner," she said.
"Let's open it and find out," I said. I reached for the knob and tried it, but it wouldn't turn.
"It's locked."
Emma put her hand on the knob and kept it there for several seconds. It began to drip water as ice melted from inside it.
"Not locked," she said. "Frozen."
She twisted the knob and pushed the door, but it opened only an inch. Snow was piled up on the other side. We put our shoulders to its surface and, on the count of three, shoved. The door flung open and a gust of Arctic air slapped us. Snow flurried everywhere, into our eyes, into the hall behind us. Shielding our faces, we peered inside. It was furnished like the other rooms, bed,
wardrobe, night table, but there were indistinct humps of white buried under deep piled snow.
"What is this?"
I said, shouting to be heard above the wind's howl.
"Another loop? It can't be,"
Emma shouted back.
"We're already in one."
Leaning into the wind, we stepped inside for a closer look. I'd thought that the snow and ice were coming through an open window, but then the flurry abated, and I saw there was no window at all, not even a wall at the far end of the room. Ice-coated walls stood on either side of us, a ceiling above us, and probably a carpet was somewhere below our feet. But where a fourth wall should have been, the room gave way to an ice cave, and beyond that, to open air, open ground, and an endless vista of white snow and black rocks. This was, as near as I could tell, Siberia. A single track of shoveled snow led through the room and into the whiteness beyond. We shuffled down the path, out of the room and into the cave, marveling at everything around us. Giant spikes of ice rose from the floor and hung from the ceiling like a forest of white trees. Emma was hard to impress. She was nearly 100 years old and had seen a lifetime's worth of peculiar things. But this place seemed to fill her with genuine wonder.
"This is astonishing," she said,
bending to scoop up a handful of snow. She tossed it at me, laughing.
"Isn't it astonishing?"
"It is," I said through chattering teeth.
"But what's it doing here?"
We threaded between the giant icicles and emerged into the open. Looking back, I could no longer see the room at all. It was perfectly camouflaged inside the cave. Emma hurried ahead, then turned back and said,
"Over here!"
in an urgent voice. I shuffled through deepening snow to her side. The landscape was bizarre. Before us was a white, flat field, past which the ground fell away in deep, undulating folds, like crevasses.
"We're not alone,"
said Emma, and pointed to a detail I'd missed. A man was standing at the edge of a crevasse, peering down into it.
"What's he doing?"
I said, more or less rhetorically.
"Looking for something, it would seem."
We watched him walk slowly along the crevasse, always staring down. After about a minute, I realized I was so cold that I could no longer feel my face. A gust of snowy wind blew up and blanked the scene. When it died down a moment later, the man was staring right at us. Emma stiffened.
"Uh-oh. Do you think he sees us?"
Emma looked down at her bright yellow dress.
"Yes."
We stood there for a moment, our eyes locked on the man as he stared at us across the white wasteland, and then he took off running in our direction. He was hundreds of yards away through deep snow and a landscape of undulating fissures. It was unclear whether he meant us harm, but we were in a place we weren't supposed to be, and it seemed like the best thing to do was leave. A decision that was soundly reinforced by a howl, the likes of which I'd heard only once before, in the gypsies' camp. A bear. A quick look over our shoulders confirmed it. A giant black bear had clawed its way up from one of the crevasses to join the man on the snow, and they were both coming after us. The bear clearing ground much more quickly than the man.
"Bear!"
I shouted, redundantly. I tried to run, but my frozen feet refused to cooperate. Seemingly impervious to the cold, Emma grabbed my arm and swept me along.
We lurched back into the cave, stumbled through the room, and tripped out the door, around which a penumbra of blowing snow was filling the hallway. I pulled the door shut behind us, as if that would stop a bear, and we retraced our steps down the long hall, down the stairs, and back into Bentham's dead museum to hide ourselves among his white-draped phantoms. We hid between a wall and a hulking, dust-sheeted monolith in the farthest corner we could find, straight-jacketing ourselves into a space so narrow that we could not turn to face each other, the cold we'd run from settling firmly into our bones. We stood silent and shivering, stiff as mannequins, the snow on our clothes melting into puddles at our feet. Emma's left hand took my right. It was all the warmth and meaning we could trade. We were developing a language that was entirely untranslatable into words, a special vocabulary of gestures and glances and touches and increasingly deep kisses that was growing richer, more intense, more complex by the hour. It was fascinating and essential, and in moments like this, made me just a little less cold and a little less scared than I might have been otherwise. When, after a few minutes, no bears showed up to eat us, we dared to exchange whispers.
"Was that a loop we were in?" I asked. "A loop within a loop?"
"I don't know what that was," Emma replied.
"Siberia. That's what the door said."
"If that was Siberia, then the room it was in was some kind of portal, not a loop. And portals don't exist, of course."
"Of course," I replied, though it wouldn't have been so strange to believe, in a world where time loops existed, that portals did too. "What if it was just a really old loop?" I suggested. "Like Ice Age old. 10 or 15,000 years. Devil's Acre might have looked like that back then."
"I don't think there are any loops that ancient," Emma said.
My teeth chattered. "I can't stop shaking," I said.
Emma pressed her side to mine and rubbed my back with her warm hand.
"If I could make a portal to anywhere," I said, "Siberia would not be high on my list of choices."
"Where would you go, then?"
"Hawaii, maybe? Though I guess that's boring. Everyone would say Hawaii."
"Not me."
"Where would you go?"
"The place you're from," Emma said. "In Florida."
"Why on earth would you want to go there?"
"I think it'd be interesting to see where you grew up."
"That's sweet," I said. "There's not much to it, though. It's really quiet."
She leaned her head on my shoulder and exhaled a warm breath down my arm.
"Sounds like heaven." "You've got snow in your hair," I said, but it melted when I tried to brush it out.
I shook the cold water from my hand onto the floor, and that's when I noticed our footprints. We'd left a trail of melting snow that probably led right to our hiding spot.
"What dimwits we are," I said, pointing out the tracks. "We should have left our shoes behind."
"It's okay," said Emma. "If they haven't tracked us by now, they probably..."
Loud, clonking footsteps echoed from across the room, accompanied by the sound of a large animal breathing.
"Back to the window, quick as you can,"
Emma hissed, and we wormed out of our hiding spot. I tried to run, but slipped in a puddle. I grabbed the closest thing at hand, which happened to be the sheet covering the large object we'd been hiding behind. The sheet came ripping away, uncovering another display case with a resounding zwit, and landing me on the floor in a pile of rumpled canvas. When I looked up, the first thing I saw was a girl, not Emma, who was standing above me, but past her, inside the case, behind the glass. She had a perfectly angelic face and a ruffled dress and a bow in her hair, and she stared glassily at nothing in what seemed the permanent rictus of a taxidermied human being. I freaked. Emma turned to see what I was freaking out about, and then she freaked. She dragged me to my feet, and we ran. I'd forgotten all about the guy chasing us, the bear, Siberia. I just wanted to get out of that room, away from the stuffed girl, and far away from any possibility that Emma and I might end up like her, dead and encased behind glass. Now I knew all I needed to know about this Bentham guy. He was some kind of twisted collector, and I was sure that if we looked under more dust covers, we'd find more specimens like the girl. We sped around a corner, only to find, towering before us, a terrifying 10-foot mountain of fur and claws. We screamed, tried too late to stop running, and slid into a pile at the bear's feet. There we cowered, waiting to die. Hot, stinking breath rolled over us. Something wet and rough mopped the side of my face. I'd been licked by a bear. I'd been licked by a bear, and someone was laughing.
"Calm yourself, he won't bite," the someone said,
and I uncovered my face to see a long, furry nose and big brown eyes staring down at me. Had the bear spoken? Do bears talk about themselves in the third person?
"His name's P.T., the someone continued, "and he's my bodyguard. He's quite friendly, provided you stay on my good side. P.T., sit!"
P.T. sat, then began licking his paw instead of my face. I flipped myself right side up, wiped the slobber from my cheek, and finally saw the owner of the voice. He was an older man, a gentleman, and he wore a subtle smirk that complemented his killer outfit. Top hat, cane, gloves, and a high white collar that rose from the top of his dark jacket. He bowed slightly and tipped his hat.
"Myron Bentham, at your service."
"Back away slowly," Emma whispered in my ear, and we stood up together and sidestepped out of the bear's reach.
"We don't want any trouble, mister. Just let us go and no one gets hurt."
Bentham spread his arms and smiled.
"You're free to leave any time you like. But that would be such a disappointment. You've only just arrived, and we have so much to talk about."
"Yeah?" I said. "Maybe you can start by explaining that girl in the case over there."
"And the Siberia room," said Emma.
"You're upset, you're cold, and you're wet. Wouldn't you rather discuss all this over a pot of hot tea?"
"Yes, but I wasn't going to say so."
"We're not going anywhere with you until we know what's happening here," said Emma.
"Very well," Bentham replied, not losing an ounce of his good humor. "That was my assistant you surprised in the Siberia room, which, as you likely gathered, leads to a time loop in Siberia."
"But that's impossible," said Emma. "Siberia is thousands of miles away."
3,489, he replied. "But making interloop travel possible has been my life's work."
He turned to me.
"As for the case you uncovered, that's Sophronia Winstead. She was the first peculiar child born to the royal family of England. Fascinating life she led, if a bit tragic in the end. I have all sorts of notable peculiars here in my peculiarium,
well-known and unknown, famous and infamous, any or all of which I'm happy to show you. I have nothing to hide."
"He's a psycho," I muttered to Emma. "He just wants to stuff us and add us to his collection."
Bentham laughed. His hearing, apparently, was very sharp.
"They're only wax models, my boy. I am a collector and a preservationist, yes, but not of humans. Do you really think I waited so long to meet you, only to pull out your insides and lock you in a cabinet?"
"I've heard of stranger hobbies," I said, thinking of Enoch and his army of homunculi. "What is it you want with us?"
"All in good time," he said. "Let's get you warm and dry first. Then tea. Then..."
"I don't mean to be rude," Emma cut in, "but we've spent too much time here already. Our friends..."
"Are all right for the moment," Bentham said. "I've looked into the matter, and it isn't as close to midnight for them as you might imagine."
"How do you know?" Emma said quickly. "What do you mean, it isn't close?"
"What do you mean, looked into it?" I said, talking over her.
"All in good time," Bentham repeated. "I know it's difficult, but you must be patient. There's too much to tell all at once, and in such a sorry state."
He stretched out an arm toward us.
"Look, you're shivering."
"Fine, then," I said. "Let's have tea."
"Excellent," said Bentham.
He rapped his cane twice on the floor.
"P.T., come!"
The bear grunted in an agreeable sort of way, stood on its hind legs, and walked, waddling like a stubby-legged fat person, to where Bentham stood. Upon reaching him, the animal bent down and scooped him into the air, carrying him like a baby, one paw supporting his back and the other his legs.
"I know it's an unconventional way to travel," Bentham said over P.T.'s bushy shoulder, "but I tire easily."
He pointed ahead of them with his cane and said,
"P.T., library!"
Emma and I watched in amazement as P.T. began to walk away with Mr. Bentham. "You don't see that every day," I thought, which was true of nearly everything I'd seen that day.
"P.T., stop!"
Bentham commanded. The bear stopped. Bentham waved to us.
"Are you coming?"
We'd been staring.
"Sorry,"
Emma said, and we ran to catch up. We wended our way through the maze after Bentham and his bear.
"Is your bear peculiar?" I asked.
"Yes, he's a grim bear," said Bentham, rubbing P.T.'s shoulder affectionately. "They are the preferred companion of Imbrins in Russia and Finland, and grim bear taming is an old and respected art among peculiars there. They're strong enough to fight off a hologast, yet gentle enough to care for a child. They're warmer than electric blankets on winter nights, and they make fearsome protectors, as you'll see here. P.T., left!"
As Bentham extolled the virtues of grim bears, we came into a small anteroom. Under a glass canopy in the middle of the room were three ladies, and, towering over them, a giant, vicious-looking bear. My breath caught for a moment before I realized they were motionless, another of Bentham's displays.
"That's Miss Waxwing, Miss Trupial, and Miss Grebe," Bentham said. "And their grim, Alexei."
The grim bear, on second look, appeared to be protecting the wax Imbrins. The ladies were posed calmly around it, while the bear was raised on its hind legs, frozen in mid-roar while swiping its paw at an enemy. Its other paw rested almost sweetly on one of the Imbrin's shoulders, and her fingers were hooked around one of its long nails, as if to demonstrate her casual mastery over such a fearsome creature.
"Alexei was P.T.'s great-uncle,"
Bentham said.
Say hello to your uncle, P.T.
P.T. grunted.
If only you could do that with Hollows,
Emma whispered to me. How long does it take to train a Grimbear? I asked Bentham.
Years,
he replied. Grims are naturally very independent.
Years,
I whispered to Emma. Emma rolled her eyes.
And is Alexei made of wax, too?
She said to Bentham.
Oh, no, he's taxidermy.
Apparently Bentham's aversion to stuffing peculiar folk did not extend to peculiar animals. If Addison were here, I thought, there'd be fireworks. I shivered. Emma ran a warm hand up my back. Bentham noticed, too, and said,
Forgive me. I so seldom have visitors that I can't help showing off my collection when they come. Now, I keep promising tea, and tea there shall be.
Bentham pointed his cane, and P.T. resumed walking. We followed them out of the dust-sheeted artifact storerooms through other parts of the house. It was in many ways the home of an average rich man. There was a marble-columned entry hall, a formal dining room with tapestried walls and seating for dozens, wings whose sole purpose seemed to be the display of tastefully arranged furnishings. But in each room, alongside everything else, were always a few objects from Bentham's peculiar collection.
15th century Spain, he said, indicating a gleaming suit of armor standing in a hall. Had it made new. Fits me like a glove.
At last we came to the library, the most beautiful I'd ever seen. Bentham told P.T. to set him down, brushed fur from his jacket, and showed us in. The room was 3 stories high at least, with shelves rising to dizzying heights above us. An array of staircases, catwalks, and rolling ladders had been constructed to reach them.
I confess I haven't read them all, Bentham said, but I'm working on it.
He ushered us toward a battalion of couches surrounding a flaming hearth whose warmth filled the room. Waiting by the fire were Sharon and Nim.
Call me an untrustworthy lout,
Sharon hissed, but before he berated me further, Bentham shooed him away to fetch us blankets. We were under the protection of the master's good graces, and Sharon's tongue-lashing would have to wait. Within a minute we were seated on a couch and wrapped in blankets. Nim fluttered around preparing tea on gilded trays, and P.T., curled before the flames, was fast settling into a state of hibernation. I tried to resist the feeling of cozy contentedness that was beginning to settle over me and focus on our unfinished business. The big questions and seemingly intractable problems. Our friends and Imbrin's. The absurd and hopeless task we had assigned ourselves. It was enough to crush me if I thought about it all at once. So I asked Nim for 3 lumps of sugar and enough cream to turn the tea white, then downed it in 3 gulps and asked for more. Sharon had retreated to a corner where he could sulk but still overhear our conversation. Emma was eager to dispense with the formalities.
So, she said, can we talk now?
Bentham ignored her. He was sitting across from us, but staring at me, the oddest little grin on his face.
What?
I said, wiping a dribble of tea from my chin.
It's uncanny, he replied. You're the spitting image.
Of who?
Of your grandfather, of course.
I lowered my teacup.
You knew him?
I did.
He was a friend to me. Long ago, when I badly needed one.
I glanced at Emma. She'd gone a bit pale and was clenching her teacup.
He died a few months ago, I said.
Yes, I was very sorry to hear it,
Bentham said. And surprised, to be honest, that he held out as long as he did. I assumed he'd been killed years ago. He had so many enemies, but he was exceedingly talented, your grandfather.
What was the nature of your friendship, exactly? Said Emma, her tone like a police interrogator's.
And you must be Emma Bloom, Bentham said, finally looking at her. I've heard a great deal about you. She seemed surprised.
You have?
Oh, yes. Abraham was very fond of you.
That's news to me, she said, blushing.
You're even prettier than he said you were.
She clenched her jaw. Thank you, she said flatly. How did you know him?
Bentham's smile wilted. Down to business, then.
If you wouldn't mind.
Not at all, he said, though his demeanor had cooled by a few degrees. Now, you asked me before about the Siberia room, and I know, Miss Bloom, that you were unsatisfied with the answer I gave.
Yes, but we are more interested in Jacob's grandfather and why you brought us here.
They are related, I promise. That room, and this house generally, is the place to begin.
Okay, I said. Tell us about the house.
Bentham took a breath and steepled his fingers against his lips for a moment, thinking. Then he said, This house is filled with priceless artifacts I've brought back over a lifetime of expeditions, but none are more valuable than the house itself. It is a machine, a device of my own invention. I call it the Panlupticon.
Mr. Bentham's a genius, Nim said, laying a plate of sandwiches before us. Sandwich, Mr. Bentham?
Bentham waved him away. But even that is not quite bedrock, he continued. My story begins long before this house was built, when I was a lad about your age, Jacob. My brother and I fancied ourselves explorers. We pored over the maps of Perplexus Anomalous, and dreamed of visiting all the loops he'd discovered, of finding new ones and visiting them not just once, but again and again. In this way we hoped to make Peculiardom great again. He leaned forward. Do you understand what I mean?
I frowned. Make it great with maps?
No, not just with maps. Ask yourself. What makes us weak, as a people?
Whites, Emma guessed.
Hollows, I said. Before either of them existed, Bentham prodded.
Emma said, Persecution by normals?
No, that is just a symptom of our weakness. What makes us weak is geography. There are, by my rough estimate, some 10,000 peculiars in the world today. We know there must be, just as we know there must be other planets in the universe that harbor intelligent life. It is mathematically mandatory. He smiled and sipped his tea. Now, just imagine 10,000 peculiars, all with astounding talents, all in one place and united by a common cause. They'd be a power to be reckoned with, no?
I suppose so, Emma said.
Most definitely so, Bentham said. But we are splintered by geography into hundreds of weak subunits, 10 peculiars here, 12 there, because it is extraordinarily difficult to travel from a loop in the Australian outback, for example, to a loop in the Horn of Africa. There are not only the inherent dangers of normals and the natural world to consider, but the dangers of aging forward during a long journey. The tyranny of geography precludes all but the most cursory visits between distant loops, even in this modern era of air travel.
He paused for a moment before continuing, his eyes scanning the room.
Now then, imagine there was a link between that loop in Australia and the one in Africa. Suddenly, those two populations could develop a relationship, trade with each other, learn from each other, band together to defend each other in times of crisis. All sorts of exciting possibilities arise, which were previously impossible. And gradually, as more and more such connections are made, the peculiar world is transformed from a collection of far-flung tribes hiding in isolated loops to a mighty nation, united and strong. Bentham had grown increasingly animated as he spoke, and at this last bit he'd raised his hands and spread his fingers like he was grasping for an invisible pull-up bar. "Hence the machine?" I ventured. "Hence the machine," he said, lowering his hands. "We'd been searching, my brother and I, for an easier way to explore the peculiar world, and instead we hit upon a way to unite it. The Panlupticon was to be the savior of our people, an invention that would change the nature of peculiar society forever. It works like this. You begin here, in the house, with a small piece of the machine called a shuttle. It fits in your hand," he said, opening his palm. "You take it with you, out of the house, out of the loop, and then across the present to another loop, which could be on the other side of the world, or the next village over. And when you return here, the shuttle will have collected and brought back the DNA-like signature of that other loop, which can be used to grow a second entrance to it, here, inside this house." "In that hallway upstairs," Emma guessed, "with all the doors and little plaques." "Exactly," said Bentham. "Every one of those rooms is a loop entrance that my brother and I, over the course of many years, harvested and brought back. With the Panlupticon, the initial arduous trek of first contact has to be made only once, and every return trip thereafter is instantaneous." "Like laying telegraph lines," Emma said.
"Just so," said Bentham. "And in that way, theoretically, the house becomes a central repository for all loops everywhere."
I thought about that, about how hard it had been to reach Miss Peregrine's loop the first time. What if instead of having to go all the way to a little island off the coast of Wales, I could have entered Miss Peregrine's loop from my closet in Englewood? I could have lived both lives, at home with my parents, and here with my friends and Emma. Except, if that had existed, Grandpa Portman and Emma never would have had to break up. Which was a sentence so strange, it gave me the tailbone-tingling willies. Bentham stopped and sipped his tea.
"Cold," he said, and set it down.
Emma peeled off her blanket, got up, crossed the floor to Bentham's couch, and dipped the tip of her index finger in his tea. In a moment, it was boiling again. He grinned at her.
"Fantastic," he said.
She removed her finger.
"One question."
"I'll bet I know what it is," Bentham said.
"Okay. What is it?"
"If such a wonderful thing really exists, why haven't you heard about it before now?"
"That's it," she said, and returned to sit next to me.
"You never heard about it, no one did, because of the unfortunate trouble with my brother." Bentham's expression darkened. "The machine was born with his help, but ultimately, he was its downfall as well. Ultimately, the Panlupticon was never used as a tool to unite our people as it was intended, but for quite the opposite purpose. The trouble began when we realized that the task of visiting every loop in the world so that we might recreate their entrances here was laughable at best, so far beyond our abilities that it bordered on delusional. We needed help,
and a great deal of it. Luckily, my brother was such a charismatic and convincing fellow that recruiting all the help we needed proved easy. Before long, we had a small army of young, idealistic peculiars willing to risk life and limb to help us achieve our dream. What I didn't realize at the time was that my brother had a different dream than I did. A hidden agenda. With some effort, Bentham stood up. "There is a legend," he said. "You might know it, Miss Bloom." Tapping with his cane, he moved across the floor to the shelves and pulled down a small book. "It's the tale of a lost loop, a kind of afterworld where our peculiar souls are stored after we die."
"Abaton," Emma said. "Sure, I've heard of it, but it's just a legend."
"Perhaps you can tell the tale," he said, "for the benefit of our neophyte friend." Bentham hobbled back to the couches and handed me the book. It was slim and green and so old it crumbled around the edges. On the front was printed, "Tales of the Peculiar."
"I've read this," I said. "Part of it, at least."
"This edition is nearly 600 years old," said Bentham. "It was the last to contain the story Miss Bloom is about to recount, because it was regarded as dangerous. For a time, it was a criminal act simply to tell it, and thus the book you hold is the only volume in the history of peculiardom ever to have been banned." I opened the book. Every page was handwritten in ornate, superhumanly neat script, and every margin was crowded with illustrations.
"It's been a long time since I heard it," Emma said tentatively.
"I'll help you along," Bentham said, lowering himself gently onto the couch. "Go on."
"Well," Emma began, "the legend goes that back in the old days, the really, really thousands of years ago old days, there was a special loop peculiars went to when they died."
"Peculiar heaven," I said.
"Not quite. We didn't stay there for all eternity or anything. It was more like a library."
She seemed uncertain of her word choice and looked to Bentham.
"Right?"
"Yes," he said, nodding. "It was thought that peculiar souls were a precious thing in limited supply, and it would be a waste to take them with us to the grave. Instead, at the end of our lives, we were to make a pilgrimage to the library, where our souls would be deposited for future use by others. Even in spiritual matters, we peculiars have always been frugal-minded."
"The first law of thermodynamics," I said.
He looked at me blankly.
"Matter can neither be created nor destroyed, or souls, in this case."
Sometimes I surprise myself with the things I remember from school. "The principle is similar, I suppose," said Bentham. "The ancients believed that only a certain number of peculiar souls were available to humanity, and that when a peculiar was born, he or she checked one out, as you or I might borrow a book from a library." He gestured at the stacks around us. "But when your life, your borrowing term, was over, the soul had to be returned." Bentham gestured to Emma. "Please, go on."
"So," Emma said, "there is this library. I always imagined it filled with beautiful glowing books, each containing a peculiar soul. For thousands of years, people checked out souls and returned them just before they died, and everything was rosy. Then, one day, someone figured out that you could break into the library, even if you weren't about to die. And he did break in, and then robbed the place. He stole the most powerful souls he could find and used them to wreak havoc."
Emma looked at Bentham.
"Right?"
factually correct, if a bit artless in the telling, Bentham said.
Used them, I said. How?
By combining their powers with his own, Bentham explained. Eventually the library's guardians killed the rogue, took back the stolen souls, and set things aright. But the genie was out of the bottle, so to speak. The knowledge that the library could be breached became a poison that spread throughout our society. Whoever controlled the library could dominate all peculiardom, and before long more souls were stolen. There dawned a dark time in which the power-mad waged epic battles against one another for control of Abaddon and the Library of Souls. Many lives were lost. The land was scorched. Famine and pestilence reigned, while peculiars with power beyond imagination murdered one another with floods and lightning bolts. This is where normals got their tales of gods fighting for supremacy in the sky. Their clash of the titans was our battle for the Library of Souls.
I thought you said this story wasn't real, I said.
I'm getting to that, Bentham said, then turned to Nim, who was hovering nearby. You can go, Nim. We don't need any more tea.
Sorry, sir. Didn't mean to eavesdrop, sir, but this is my favourite part.
Then sit!
Nim dropped cross-legged to the floor and propped his chin on his hands. As I was saying, for a short but terrible time, destruction and misery befell our people. Control of the library changed hands often, accompanied by immense bloodletting. Then, one day, it stopped. The self-declared King of Abaddon had been killed in battle, and the one who killed him was on his way to claim the library for himself. But he never found it. Overnight, the loop had disappeared.
Disappeared? I said.
There one day, gone the next, said Emma.
Poof!
Said Nim. According to legend, the Library of Souls was located in the hills of the ancient city of Abaddon. But when the would-be king arrived to claim his prize, the library was gone. So was the town. Gone, as if they'd never been there at all. A smooth green meadow in their place.
That's crazy, I said.
There's nothing to it, though, Emma said. It's just an old tale.
The Legend of the Lost Loop, I said, reading the page that the book in my hands was open to. We may never know for certain if Abaddon is a real place, Bentham said, his lips spreading into a sphinx's smile. That's what makes it a legend. But like rumors of buried treasure, the legendariness of the story has not stopped people over the centuries from searching for it. It is said that Perplexus Anomalous himself committed years to the hunt for the lost loop of Abaddon, which is how he began to discover so many of the loops that appear on his famous maps.
I didn't know that, said Emma. I suppose something good came of it then.
And something